This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Gar Alperovitz is preparing for the next American Revolution. The nation's wealth is now concentrated in so few hands, the wealth gap growing so fast that even its most ardent defenders question whether our current form of corporate capitalism can survive. But Alperovitz's message is less about what's wrong with our system and more about what will replace it. In his recent writings, the political economist from the University of Maryland points to a number of successful examples springing up all around us, and he continues to explore a clear path forward in his latest book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gar Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He's giving a talk at the United Church of Chapel Hill tomorrow night at Duke University on Friday, and he is with us on the program now. Gar Alperovitz, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So we're talking about an American Revolution here. What do you mean? We're looking for the next American Revolution. What is that?
Well, people usually think of the word revolution as a kind of a crisis and an explosion, a big change that happens dramatically. But the real revolutions are more evolutionary, or evolutionary reconstruction is the term I use. And, you know, the press doesn't have the capacity now to study much of what's going on at the grassroots level, but they would be surprised to find 130 million Americans, 40% of America, are members of a co-op in one form or another. There are something like 10 million people in worker-owned companies, very conventional, many parts of the country, nothing fancy. They're just out there, been working for many years. There are 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood-owned corporations, land trusts, which are kind of quasi-public neighborhood or nonprofit ownership of a different form of wealth. So if you probe deeply, you see this development that hasn't been quite caught by the press yet. I think it will turn on to this very quickly. We've been seeing signs of that. That's developing partly just out of necessity. People are in great pain, and they're trying new inventions. We can talk about a couple really interesting things going on in Ohio. Partly they're just building on traditional American experience, like co-ops or municipal enterprise, like municipal utilities. 25% of American electricity comes from publicly owned city or publicly owned utilities and co-ops. If you like, they're, quote, socialist entities right here in America, but they're just practical things that most people take for granted. And they're growing, too. So there's an interesting phenomena right below the level of what the press has caught yet, a very interesting experience in which people are beginning to own wealth in a society in which wealth is so concentrated at the top that these various decentralized forms, I think, are very important, teaching people a different idea about how we democratize ownership.
Well, let's talk about that, specifically how something like a co-op is different than a corporation and how that helps build wealth and not just make jobs and income, right? So maybe we should make that distinction between jobs that create income and co-op ownership, equity ownership in your own work that actually builds wealth, and why that might be revolutionary.
It's both building wealth and also participating in the actual management of your job and your ownership. Let me give you an example that's going on in Cleveland, Ohio, in a very, very poor neighborhood. Before saying that, I should remind people that wealth ownership in the United States is almost medieval. I say that technically. 400 individuals at the top, just for you could get them in a very large, in an auditorium, have more wealth than the bottom 160 million Americans taken together. It's very extreme. So these experiments really are an alternative, very American grassroots. The Cleveland model is in a very poor part of the city. There is a large-scale, industrial-size laundry, which is owned by the workers. And in part, it provides services to the big hospitals and universities in that area who've been cooperating to help build worker-owned cooperatives. Another one is a solar installation company. Again, another worker-owned cooperative, kind of linked together with the complex, with the first one and many others, to kind of support this growth, not just one, but a group of them tied together. And it's on track to put in more solar installation than exists in the state of Ohio altogether right now. And the third one, I'm just giving you some examples of, because people think of co-ops as little tiny corner store, and many of those exist and many are good. But this is a different order. These are people owning their own work and participating and controlling it. They have just established, about 2 weeks ago, opened up the largest urban greenhouse in the United States, produces about 3 million heads of lettuce a year, 3 million. And, the way to think about that, it means every Monday morning and every Tuesday and every Wednesday, every day, 26,000 new seedlings are planted to produce 3 million heads of lettuce. And this is a worker-owned cooperative as well. So you get this complex that's developing below the radar. Most people don't know about it. And you get the universities and hospitals in the area encouraging this by buying something from these co-ops. And we're seeing this happen in a number of cities, building on this model, partly because it's very practical, very American, but also it's a way to, come across a different idea than this 400 people owning such a high percentage of the wealth and beginning to try different models at the grassroots level that actually work. And partly I think it's driven also by pain. People don't have jobs. There's 40% unemployment in this particular area. And if you don't do something new, it gets worse. So that's one of the drivers of this kind of phenomenon all across the country.
And I really want to examine this in detail. These co-ops are providing jobs. People are working. They have money. They can buy things. They pay taxes. They're providing something of value that other people are buying, and the economy grows and grows, a kind of multiplier effect. But the idea of building wealth, the 40 people who own most of the wealth are owning a piece of somebody's job, and the equity that they build in that business. In a co-op, as the business becomes more valuable, my equity grows, my security grows. And maybe you can explain how that works and how I might be able to cash out at the end of, say, 40 years of a company that may have tripled in value over that time. How would that work?
Well, it's exactly right, because people, and take these co-ops in Cleveland, it's as an example, but they're only one example. The current projection is that over 7 years, this is a very poor area. This is largely a poor central city area where people have been making an average income of about $18,000, very poor, with 40% unemployment. But in that area, this sophisticated solar and the green, it's a very green laundry, by the way, that all these institutions are very green in the greenhouse. They estimate that but within 7 years, people would be able to cash out at $65,000 in equity if they wanted to cash out. And if they stay longer, that'll just build up over time more and more. So just as a small businessman, if he's successful, not only gets his salary and his income, but he's beginning to build equity. A cooperative is exactly the same thing, except it's democratic. Everybody shares in the ownership and in the decision-making as well. So it's a very American kind of phenomenon, very decentralized. And we're seeing a rebirth of this idea, as I say, in good part because we have such great economic and social pain. People are either forced to try these things and make them work, or the pain continues. So I think you're going to see a lot more of it. I've been traveling around the country, and although you don't see it in the newspapers or in most of the radio or television, at the grassroots level, this is going on at a really fast clip.
Well, the interesting thing about this change is it represents a kind of an alternative model, alternative structures that grow side by side. In other words, you don't really have to threaten the Wall Street method of financing right now that allows other people to own your work. That can go on happily on its way. And if it's causing our pain, well, so much, that's what may happen. But in the meantime, you're saying that these alternatives are springing up as a way to replace, very patiently, very calmly, and in a non-threatening way, a model that might be the source of our pain.
I see it that way. I wear two hats. One is as a political economist and mainly looking at these things from an economic point of view, and also as a historian. If you look back at the 30 years prior to the great progressive era, what you also found at the end of the 19th century, problem after problem building up, but also new models and new ideas building up at the grassroots level that at the right moment became applying the same principles at the national level or in the years and the decades before the New Deal. Really, the place to look for things was at the grassroots level because the so-called laboratories of democracy were cooking up new things that when the right moment came, the same principles were applied at a higher level nationally. And I think that's where the real payoff is going to come at some point as the pain grows and more experience and more knowledge and more sophistication and probably more politics building up support for this kind of thing. For instance, let me give you an example that's going on. The state of North Dakota for 90 years has had a state-owned bank, public bank, and very successful, supports co-ops, but also supports farmers and small business. Well, 20 states have now introduced legislation to say, well, why don't we have a public bank and make money for the state, but also support our small business and co-ops and so forth. So it's a slightly different level, building to the state level. And again, you see that progress. And I expect probably, you never can tell, but as the pain continues, but as the sophistication grows, we may see more and more larger scale at the national level as well. That's the way these things grow. If reform doesn't take place, something's got to give at some point. And I think these models are even more important thinking about the long term because they suggest new principles for America. You know, the other piece about this, this is sort of a system that is so American in nature. It doesn't look like corporate capitalism, and it doesn't look like old-fashioned state socialism. It's very community-based, and I think it has ideas in it that may take kind of an excitement in different parts of the political spectrum.
And that is part of our sorrow, isn't it, that we can only see this binary capitalism, and there's only one form in the mind of most people when you say that. There isn't this form that we've evolved called corporate capitalism. Versus socialism, government ownership, and the idea that personal ownership, worker ownership, is one of the possibilities, really doesn't even enter our conversation.
It hasn't entered, but you know, I think that's about to change. And it breaks down these stereotypes. Why do we have to have only two?
Right.
And two of them are pretty bad in many ways. Why can't Americans are very inventive? I'm from a small city in Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin. And what we find there is I go back home and see my high school friends, one very conservative friend of mine who's a very brilliant guy. When you actually talk practically about things like these co-ops and worker-owned companies and the land trusts, other things we could talk about, you don't find the kind of ideological banter that you hear on the radio or television. You find, does it work? Does it make sense? Let's see how we can do it. And that gives me a great deal of hope if we can begin to transcend some of the crazy ideological nonsense and begin to get down and roll up our sleeves and do these things.
We had talked about public banks as one example of an idea that's growing, because the question is, how do you finance? I mean, how do you capitalize these businesses initially when you're not going to use a model that puts its primary goal, financial return on investment? Where's the money come from?
Well, here's a very interesting phenomenon. These Cleveland cooperatives that I was talking about, and they're linked together with a revolving fund, so one makes enough. They all kick back into the fund so they can build more co-ops in a kind of a linked nonprofit corporation holding them together to build the community. In the midst of the worst financial crisis in modern history, these co-ops got bank loans. Now, how did they do that? They did it because they really worked intelligently with the big universities and hospitals in the area, Case Western Reserve, the Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital. And these big institutions, they've got a lot of taxpayer money in them from universities and also in healthcare. These institutions made a commitment to purchase some part of their very large purchasing power from these co-ops. And, you know, if you walk into a local bank with either a letter of intent or a contract that says they're going to buy, it's not very hard to finance these businesses. These are intelligent businesses and intelligent business people, and they're working with people who want to support them and build the community, and it's in the interest of the universities and hospitals as well. Doesn't mean that's the only thing they're doing, but that's one of the ways you can do it. You can get your financing if you actually do it in your area, in the area we're here. These universities in this area and these hospitals could also do the same thing. There are about 20 cities are experimenting with what's now called the Cleveland model, and I think there's about 100 inquiries the folks have had from other cities. So they begin to see this thing makes sense, and also you can finance it. So it's very interesting.
So you can get loans, and obviously people can't get an equity stake because the workers have the equity, but loans which pay interest, so that also helps the economy. You say those are quite possible if you have a good business plan and a record of success.
That's right. And the guarantee of some kind. And
so
the hospitals and universities have a, have a stake in building the neighborhood as well. So it's in their interest, both financially, but also socially and politically.
Interesting to see the rise of these grassroots efforts all around the country at a time when no less a figure than Klaus Schwab, who is the founder of the World Economic Forum, has pretty much pronounced the end of capitalism as we know it. And Milton Friedman himself has said, you know, the late Milton Friedman said, America might have been better off if corporate form had never been invented or never made available to private enterprise. Are we seeing the end of corporate capitalism?
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, if you're a historian, you don't think in terms of next week or just the next election, but, you know, stand back and where are we 30 years from now? How do these things evolve? Most systems in history come and go. Revolution or fundamental change is as common as grass in world history. The Soviet Union is gone, former Soviet Union's gone, apartheid's gone, the American Revolution itself. A bunch of farmers and small, very small merchants defeated the biggest empire in the world. So I stand back with a kind of a cool look at this, and I think, you know, I'd be surprised if we don't develop something new as we move down the next couple decades. You just have to stand back a bit and recognize that's kind of the rule. Doing nothing, no big change is kind of the great exception. Things just don't last.
Gar, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Gar Alprovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He's giving a talk at the United Church of Chapel Hill tomorrow night at 7:30 and at Duke University's White Lecture Hall on Friday at 9:15 a.m. For more information, you can go to garalprovitz.com. It's spelled A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z. And his latest book is called What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. That's the state of things. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.